This is the first in a four-part series I'm calling The Jonestown Flood. Part 1. Love in the Time of Prophets. My name is Kevin Allen. Welcome to The Ends. The story goes, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Then light was let be, then day and night, sky and land. The rest, as they say, is history. What's interesting is that the Bible never mentions the creation of water. Sure, it could have been baked into the earth line, but the idea of water existing before creation has a certain allure to me. That makes it something beyond rules, beyond this cosmic order. There's a primal fascination about water, say, an inky, endless sea, that's always been here, that's always been, period. It's not good or bad, it just is. Water is a calm lake and the unsparing wash of a tsunami. Water is a spring rain and a lashing downpour. Water saves a life, or takes it. More importantly, water is in everyone, a sliver in all of us that predates morality. We erect dams of law and behavior to direct its flow, to put its power to constructive use. But dams can break, and the resulting flood can drown the world. I'm getting ahead of myself. Hell, this story isn't really even about water, but it's a good place to start. In fact, if you can believe it, this is a love story. In our beginning, there was water. The Pacific Ocean, a sweeping blue horizon. Normally, it was cold and unruly, but on this particular day, the waves and winds were on their best behavior. Then there was light, a midday sun ruling over a cloudless summer sky. Then the day, August 17th, 1969. Then the land, Ocean Beach, 3.5 miles of sand on the western edge of San Francisco. When the tide is low, sometimes you can find rotted wood from the wreck of the old clipper ship King Philip. Then the plants and grass, a garden, an especially beautiful garden, under the third floor balcony. Then a man. He was standing on that third floor balcony, above that especially beautiful garden, across the street from the 3.5 miles of sand on August 17th, 1969, under a bright midday sun, looking out onto that sweeping blue horizon. His name was Tim. Finally, a woman, walking down the great highway that separated Tim's apartment from the beach, laughing and singing with a friend. Her flowing dark hair offset her striking lavender blouse, as both swayed in the Pacific winds. Her name was Grace. She was just 19, but her focused eyes betrayed an intelligence beyond her years. It was those eyes that spotted the garden, as well as the winsome young man above it, staring out to sea. They noticed his strong jaw, not jock-like, but defined, and horn-rimmed glasses. They noticed the air of purpose around him. And Tim did have purpose. He had a trial tomorrow, where he was to defend a local black man from the charge of explosives possession and discharging a firearm. He didn't do it for the money. Tim owned a Porsche and lived in beachfront property. But rather, Tim felt something was fundamentally wrong with how America worked. As a lawyer working in Berkeley, he was exposed to the second-class citizenship of the poor and the black on a daily basis. The question of inequality burned in him ever since he moved out west from Milwaukee. As of that summer, at least, he hadn't found an answer. But all that was tomorrow Tim's problem. Right now, a pretty girl was heading right towards him. Grace stopped at the garden underneath Tim's balcony. Maybe she was tired. Maybe it was the August heat. Maybe it really was a beautiful garden. Or maybe it was Tim. She admired the greenery, let it sink in for a moment, and then looked up. For the first time, he saw her smile. Tim forgot how to breathe. Filled with equal parts joy and dread, his mind attempted to play out the next 50 scenarios at once, then promptly short-circuited. The next words to come out of her mouth, Tim knew, would be the start of something beautiful. "You have," she started, after a moment of eye contact, "a lovely garden." "Thank you," Tim responded. "I'll tell the landlady," he said, Grace's signal flying far up over his head and into outer space. Some say it's still in orbit around Venus. Grace smiled, turned back to her friend, and continued on down the Great Highway. In late October of that same year, Grace found herself at the Civic Center Plaza, just northeast of Market Street and Van Ness. The plaza occupies a privileged position in eastern San Francisco, acting as the hub in a wheel of government buildings, the library, the California Supreme Court, and City Hall. It was here, among the literal structures of the establishment, that hundreds of the discontented gathered in a thunderous rally. Grace got dragged along by her coworker Susan. She was interested, sure, but Susan was a real activist. A tap on Grace's shoulder drew her attention away from the speaker. Susan told her that she was getting up to grab some pamphlets. Grace watched her friend disappear into the crowd, then turned her head back to the pulpit. The view was unchanged, aside from the flashing pair of horn-rimmed glasses that sat down next to her. "Hi," Tim said. Neither recognized that they had seen the other that morning in August. Grace played it cool, but Tim was persistent. Eventually, he convinced her to get a Coke with him at a deli underneath his law office. He was working the weekend, Tim explained, and went to the protest to take a break from the books. Going to a counterculture rally wasn't really Grace's idea of relaxing, but she could tell Tim was passionate about this stuff. It was charming. As they spoke, Tim let slip that he'd recently moved to Berkeley. This time, Grace pushed. Berkeley was the crossroads of higher learning and social action, a mecca for searching youths like Grace. And she had never been there. Tim graciously offered to show her the sights. They drove onto the 101, across the Bay Bridge, exited at MacArthur Boulevard, Tim confidently handling his burgundy Porsche 911. The two turned right onto Telegraph Avenue. If you were upset with the social order, or were just looking for an alternative view on things, Telegraph Avenue in 1969 was the place to be. On your right is the Café Mediterranean. Beat poets, feminists, hippies, communists, freaks. Any movement or dangerous idea that flowered in the revolutionary wave of the 60s had a place in this coffee shop. No radical was too radical for the Med. Allen Ginsberg probably wrote parts of Howl here, under the, by then, already dated teal and white stripes of the cafe sign. A little down the road on your left is Cody's Books. A year ago, you could find safe haven there, after the anti-war protests turned hot, when the tear gas burned and the billy club swung. Out of the corner of your eye is Shambhala. Depending on the time of day, there's a group of young men hanging around outside for whom the phrase casual dress was a pair of gross overstatements. On the jet-black awning of the psychedelic bookstore is a simple command.
All hail to the one cosmic mind.
People's Park looms as you pass Telegraph and Hay Street. In the air, you can still taste sharp metal. Whether that's from the shovels that built the park or the blood spilled as a result is your call. Earlier that year, in May, there was a march, a buzzing, angry march, that rolled up Telegraph Avenue. The barely developed parking lot was a muddy, weeping blight, and a call went out through an underground newspaper to take it back. So, one day in April, folks gathered grass seeds, pickaxes, and mulch, and just turned that lot into a park. For a couple of weeks, the neighborhood enjoyed, albeit in a bemused way, their new park. California governor, Ronald Reagan, however, considered the park an attack on state sovereignty, as the public UC Berkeley owned the lot. Retribution was swift. On May 15th, Highway Patrol and Berkeley police officers cleared the streets and fenced off the park in the dead of night. The ire of that protest that charged down Telegraph and up to the obstructed park was only matched by the severity of the crackdown from the legions of riot police set up to meet them. The anger turned into a crashing wave of violence. Protesters threw concrete and fists. Police used gas and buckshot. Berkeley turned into a war zone. In the end, the state ceded the park, but not before one student, James Rector, was killed. Protest had a price. It was Telegraph Avenue, this street of so much thought and peace and protest and violence and strangeness, that Tim and Grace found themselves on in the twilight of the 60s. But all of that seemed to melt away for a little while. The war, the Soviets, and the police. The dreamers, the wanderers, and the lost. The sky, the sun, and even the sea. Until it was only Grace and Tim. For the first time, he saw her smile. A month later, Tim wanted to share more of his life with Grace. Not marriage, not yet. They were already an item, sure. They already basically spent every weekend together, read each other's short stories by de Maupassant, and did 100 other sappy things that all new couples tend to do. Though they did have to do those things through public transit, since Tim had sold his Porsche a few weeks ago. Tim wanted to walk the walk, and a proper environmentalist, he reasoned, didn't own a 6-cylinder, 148-horsepower scream machine. Which was why Grace found herself in a car, owned by a black San Franciscan couple, her and Tim in the back seat, driving up to Redwood Valley, California. City lights dimmed as the car wound up hills dotted with pine trees, snaking around tiny vineyards and orchards. The hard November rain made sightseeing difficult, however. So Grace focused on Tim. He had been talking excitedly this whole time about what Grace was going to experience, how wonderful and transcendent it was going to be. But his words muted as his eyes drew her attention. They still had his same purpose, but it was like the Tim in them was gone, drowned in some oily, alien flood. She knew Tim had a bit of mystery to him. That's part of what attracted her in the first place. But this new layer she was peeling back was from somewhere else. The car pulled up to the plain timber building. The headquarters of the church that Tim had dived into headfirst and now wanted to share with Grace. He told her with delight he was taking her to meet his friend, the speaker, the healer, the prophet. The Reverend Jim Jones, after all, loved new faces.